Welcome to the Untangling Web3 podcast. So as you've probably heard, DAOs are reshaping governance, enabling decentralized decision-making without traditional hierarchies. Today, we're sitting down with Dan Lebo to explore their impact. So Dan is the founder of Lightball Capital and former CIO of the Modular Blockchain Fund. He's an affiliate faculty member at Singapore Management University, teaching blockchain and DeFi, and lectures in ESEC's Masters in Finance program. His research on blockchain and financial markets has been published by Springer and MIT Press. He's also an associate editor-in-chief of World Scientific Annual Review of FinTech and is completing a PhD in finance at the Erasmus University. God, he's got a lot on. So Dan, without further ado, welcome to the show, and we're very excited to have you on.
Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to this conversation. We've been trying for a while, so good that we got together today.
Yeah, we met in Hive like a year ago or something like this, Dan. And someone was like, Alec, you have to get this guy on the show. He's really good. He knows lots about DAOs. And I was like, yeah, it's taken this long to get you on, but it's finally happening. So I think it's perfect timing.
So obviously today, the big topic is DAOs. Now, it's something that we've talked about kind of loosely on the show before, here and there. But I don't think we've given it the full justice of a deep dive. So I'm really glad we've got you, Dan, a bit of an expert in this field. So why don't we kick it off there with a kind of 101 explainer. What actually are DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations, and why should we actually be caring about them? Because a lot of people will hear the term and they'll think, what on earth does that mean? But yeah, how would you describe them?
Yeah, I mean, there are a whole bunch of different definitions that fly around in different academic papers, but if I had to summarize what they all sort of say is that it is a new form of organization that helps people with the same objective to pursue their goals. They're all blockchain based, so they record their decisions on blockchain. And often they have a governance module where some members of the community can put forward proposals, and then everyone else who has a governance token and a voting right that comes with it can vote on these proposals to say yay or nay. Okay. Does that make sense?
Simple. Wow. That was like, explain it like I'm five. I like it. So like, how does this differ to traditional setups? Like, especially when we're thinking like, you know, early days, tribal, you know, everyone just having a conversation, and that seems kind of, you know, decentralized in a way potentially. How does it compare to what we're experiencing, say, in the modern times as well?
I mean, the probably the most important comparison is the one with the private limited company, right? Because that's the sort of one way that we tend to organize for economic activity, at least. And it's quite interesting. So in DAOs, technically speaking, anyone can join, right? Whereas in a company, you have to buy shares, and then your name's going to be recorded on the share register and so on. Companies usually also sell shares that come with a cash flow right. So if you own a stock, then you're entitled to get some sort of dividend payment or something like that. That's not necessarily the case in the DAO context. So in the DAO context, basically, and I'm making some generalizations here, so forgive me if it's not true for all DAOs in the world, but often if you buy a governance token, you're buying a voting right, right? So to participate in that governance ecosystem.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think that's a sort of most prevalent and most important difference, I would say.
Yeah, I think that tallies with kind of my understanding as well. And what I've seen from them is, you know, yeah, very much typically you're holding a token to participate in the decision making around whatever this organization is. Like, I think the one I always come back to as an example, just because it's kind of illustrative, is Constitution DAO, right? You had this DAO where people were trying to kind of pool funds together in order to buy the Constitution, right? And that's something that you can't do by traditional means, right? How do you coordinate something like that? How do you raise those kind of funds for a very specific purpose? And owning the kind of governance token was part of that. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Can you maybe just in an abstract sense, before we kind of dive into the technical details at all, why would people want to decentralize an organization? Because it sounds like something very futuristic and strange. And you think like, okay, a company is something that is fairly kind of mentally tangible, right? You can understand what it looks like. You have a hierarchy imposed on it. That makes sense. How does that actually translate? And why would you want to translate an organizational structure into a decentralized model with this voting mechanism?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. And I think I want to answer by saying that we shouldn't necessarily transfer all sorts of for-profit company type entities into DAOs. So while I have spent quite a significant amount of my last 2 years on investigating DAOs, I'm not the kind of person that will tell you that we have to DAO everything. Okay. But there are some specific use cases where perhaps it makes more sense to organize yourself as a DAO than as a company. And I think that is especially the case in the context of perhaps not-for-profit type of scenarios. So I'm not saying that's the only thing, but I was just having lunch with a dear friend of mine today. He runs an award ceremony, and he wants to expand this award that has to do with financial literacy beyond its current size. So he's like, Daniel, should I create a company or a media company, or should it be a DAO, or should it be what? So that is kind of an interesting use case, right? Because you have a whole bunch of different type of actors that contribute to this award seminar. You know, you have the judges, you have the people who sponsor the awards, then you have the people who submit their proposals to get an award across all the different categories, right? So you can easily imagine how you can develop a nice token economy where all of these participants basically take place in that market and purchase the tokens for certain reasons and get paid in tokens for certain reasons, and then also can participate in developing and implementing the strategy as they put up proposals and vote on the different proposals that are out there.
Okay. Yeah. And another like big advantage in my mind, and this probably relates to the crypto aspect, and that is around like the community engagement. The fact that you're saying that in a private company, you have to buy shares. It's in a private way. You typically have to get approval. There's different, say, share classes and rights to vote and whatnot. And it's very, I guess, black boxy in a way. Whereas one of the big sales of DAOs and crypto projects is that realistically, you know the rules. There's a degree of transparency. That's the on-chain element you're talking about. But also, almost anyone can participate if they've got money, obviously, and that's kind of the private angle. I can buy almost any crypto asset and be involved in that crypto project and then potentially vote using the underlying assets. And that you're saying there's not really a degree of profitability. I guess the profitability is the number go up on the underlying crypto asset. Is that something that's quite unique with DAOs, would you say, that anyone can get involved?
I mean, it is, but it's also a bit of a problem. So in the book that I put together with Sandy Oh, my dear co-author, we talk about this set of idiosyncratic risks that exist in the DAO context. And then one of the risks is what we call the DAO accountability risk. And that risk basically describes this situation where you're not really able to identify clearly who's responsible for the DAO's and the members' actions, right? So as good as it sounds that anyone can join, you also run into trouble if you perhaps want to open a bank account or if you want to interface with the financial services industry overall. So it's not only good. Yeah? It's good that everyone can play, but it also brings some idiosyncratic risks, which in the case of a private limited company, you don't even have, because you can just look at the share register and you know who the ultimate beneficial owners are and so on.
Yeah, and like the kind of this point about anyone can participate as well, it maybe creates other issues along the lines of, okay, if these people are voting on, say, consensus upgrades, how many people that own Bitcoin understand how to, like, what a consensus upgrade means, or whether we should go one way or another way? And it starts to bring around the problem of specializations versus generalizations. Like, should they be voting on deeply technical things that we've seen in a lot of democracies around the world? Actually, the power of the people isn't always the right decision for the people. Is this another problem we're starting to see?
I mean, I think it depends a little bit. You can define constraints around what decisions are up for a vote or not. And you can also implement, for example, different thresholds, right? You could say, okay, if there's something that is mission critical, for example, a consensus upgrade, then maybe the majority vote comes in a very different sort of comes at a different threshold than if you just say, okay, I need a simple majority, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of one thing. I mean, people have gone different paths to retain certain levels of control. That is also good and bad, by the way, because you want to call yourself decentralized autonomous organization, and then you're very concentrated in terms of voting power is also not so good. But I think, it's a two-edged sword as well. Yeah, I would be quite careful to manage especially these technical upgrades, because we can also talk about the different types of proposals that people usually put forward, right? So there's basically two types. There are these technical changes, which can be quite critical to the operating of the protocol. And then you have these other ones that are basically asking for money in its very simplistic form, right? And it's like, okay, the DAO has a treasury and has some money. And then I believe that with my proposal, I can create something that contributes to the ecosystem and is a net benefit to the ecosystem. So I need a bunch of money, and then I put forward my proposal and ask for it. So these are obviously less systematically critical, but you also want guardrails there, right? Because you don't want somebody to just drain your treasury, for example. And there's also new research by, I think, some folks from ETH that are looking at DAO attacks and all the different permutations of what bad actors are trying to do to get hold of these treasury assets, right? So that's also something that we have to continue to watch.
And to bring it back to like the different, you know, the analogy of the different shareholders in a private limited company, what different rights are, is it typically that so the kind of the distribution or the separation I'd imagine in most say blockchain networks would be you have validators or miners as one kind of, you know, citizen class, and then token holders as the other. And in that technical upgrade, I guess is it mostly validators and miners that would have the weight and the vote on, you know, how we should upgrade certain consensus mechanism issues and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And then the typical token holders who vote, say, on the allocation of treasury or where the money should go. Is that the kind of what we tend to see, or?
Mm-hmm. It depends. I mean, not all DAOs are the same, but often the DAO is the overarching decision-making vehicle across the entire ecosystem. So it's not like the technical matters can only be decided by maybe the validators, yeah? But I do want to highlight that there's a kind of one little distinction in some ecosystems, at least in the prominent ones on Ethereum, for example, where you can delegate your vote. Yeah? So if you bought a bunch of UNI token, for example, and you just believe that UNI is the greatest platform of all times and you want to participate in the sort of capital gain over the next 5 years, but you really don't understand how an AMM works and whether the fee switch should be turned off or on. And so you feel like, you know, I can't really contribute much here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try and do a little bit of research to figure out who I can delegate my voting power to. And then there are folks that are, you know, have lots of delegations from other people. So I choose the one that I feel can represent my point of view best. And then I delegate my votes to them. And then they will basically use my voting power to believe what to implement or to act on what they believe is the best, yeah, for each proposal.
That's really interesting. It very much sounds like a form of kind of representative democracy then, when you're delegating the power to do something to someone you've elected. But in this case, you're very much electing them with your money, right? You're putting your tokens where your beliefs are, where you, in the other actors who you think will make the best decision. So that's really interesting, because it's taking what most of us know of in kind of most representative democracies to a kind of slightly different place for this context. Also, you mentioned there Uniswap, which I think is, I'm glad you brought that up, because it shows there's quite a diverse range of different reasons why you might create a DAO. So obviously Uniswap, you have that for the operations of the automated market maker. We had things like the DAO as well for Ethereum, which had the hack associated with it that everyone's kind of familiar with. Constitution DAO that we mentioned. And then you also have, you know, as Alex said, blockchains being underpinned in some sense by DAOs themselves, right? So things like the Internet Computer Protocol. There's making decisions on the network level, right? So we've got a whole bunch of different things there. I wonder, could you maybe pick a kind of a typical use case for a DAO? So what, you know, one that you might see spring up today or tomorrow, and take us through the kind of life cycle. So what does it actually look like? Who sets one up? How do they set one up? How do people get involved? That kind of thing. So I think that would really help to make things more tangible.
Yeah. I mean, you've mentioned a whole bunch of them already. And in our book, again, we have a whole chapter on the different types of DAOs, because it is actually a little bit complicated to make sense of what the purposes of all of these different DAOs are. And you mentioned there are protocol DAOs. Then I think at the moment, probably the biggest group of DAOs are the ones that operate DeFi platforms, at least the most prominent ones, right? And then, of course, Uniswap is the kind of very big one in the room. And if you ask me, you know, why do these guys set up DAOs and don't run it all as a company? It's probably to do with the fact that the ethos of creating blockchain-based platforms is that we're creating something that is more akin to a public good rather than to some profit-making company, right? So I think when Uniswap was set up, probably the idea was to say, okay, this AMM functionality is so fundamental to a lot of the crypto activity that's happening today, you know, swapping one token for the next. You kind of need to have that, and we want to build it in a way that it's not run centrally by some platform that governs the rules, but we want it to be run by the community. So I think that's how often these projects start, where they say, okay, we really need to have community-based decision-making because we believe that what we've created is a public good. This idea of a public good, right, goes back to Elinor Ostrom, who won the Nobel Prize in economics a long time ago. But interestingly, she only looked at very small communities that governed a local public good. You know, think about fish in the sea or water under the ground and so on. So it's kind of an open question whether the concept of governing a public good through the community works on such a global level, because of course blockchains, you know, don't know any jurisdiction, they don't know any borders, and they operate 24/7. So that is actually an interesting research question that maybe something to look at in the future.
100% right. I think that is, I really find this topic of public goods and what they mean interesting, because obviously people often describe blockchains as a certain type of new public good, where you have, you know, the mining network or the staking network that's securing them. I think another example that we didn't mention actually is our sponsor on the show, VBetterDAO. Obviously they are kind of working on how to allocate funds towards various sustainability initiatives, and kind of doing using that public good aspect, but on a more local or small scale level, distributed across lots of different use cases. And I think that's really an interesting way of describing actually what VBetterDAO do. So I'm glad you mentioned that. Okay, let's say someone has, you know, and maybe even it's worth mentioning, where does someone go to find out what DAOs exist, right? They don't go on Companies House in the UK to search up company names, or they don't, you know, where would people discover one? And then let's say I find a DAO that particularly resonates with me. What does the process look like for actually getting involved, right? Because you have to presumably acquire some of the governance tokens. How does one normally go about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a bunch of platforms that list DAOs almost similar to what we perhaps know from the world of cryptocurrencies. You know, there's an equivalent to CoinMarketCap, I would say. There's one called DeepDAO, for example, where lots and lots of different DAOs are listed. And you can, you know, see the size of the treasury, and you can see how many proposals they put forward and some other statistics. So that's perhaps a good starting point. But I think this is not really how it works, right? Like, people don't wake up and say, I want to be a member of a DAO today. You know, that's really not how it works. So people care about some cause, and then eventually they search for ways to get involved in that cause. And again, VBetaDAO is a good example, right? Maybe some people are really excited about sustainability and they have a specific idea, but they don't know yet how to bootstrap and implement this idea. And I think that's when they go to VBetaDAO. And in the book, we also have the afterword that is actually written by Sunny. So he also draws a little bit of a picture on where this is all going in the future. And of course, if you met Sunny, you know that he's quite a visionary guy and he thinks very big. So it's also interesting to see how some of the people today already see DAOs play a much bigger role in the future. Yeah.
And that's quite a nice bridge to the next topic. You said that a lot of these things start as public goods rather than money-making schemes necessarily. But one of the things that VBetaDAO does, obviously, is kind of combine those two things. It's you can do a public good, but also monetize that. And like the link there is sustainability, you know, to kind of exist in our current paradigm of capitalism or whatever. You should be able to make money and profit from these things. That's the primary motivator for a lot of people beyond just, you know, doing something nice. And, you wrote a book. You've already mentioned it very briefly, but I'll just say that book is called Decentralized Autonomous Organizations. There we go. How finance can interact with blockchain-based DAOs. But this kind of like, this is a nice kind of bridge to what we were just talking about is, you know, finance is obviously for profit. So why should the finance industry be interested in DAOs? Like, what's their role there?
Yeah. So it's interesting. Sandy's and my hunch was that as DAOs get bigger and bigger treasuries, eventually some smart banker will wake up one morning and say, how do I get these guys as a client? Because anyone who has money is a potential client, right? So that was a bit of a hunch, and we started writing the book with that in mind, right? If that happened one day, DAOs are big enough for traditional financial institutions to care, then maybe we can add something to the table with our book where we describe the risks and what you have to think about if you want to do business with a DAO. And halfway through, I kid you not, two bigger DAOs started doing exactly that, right? So if you remember, MakerDAO put out an RFP for $1 billion worth of money to be managed by a traditional financial institution. And I think Securitize and BlackRock basically got it. Some other asset managers, including Singapore-based Open Eden, I think also got a chunk of that. So that was one. And then I think Arbitrum was in a similar situation, right? They said, oh, our concentration in our DAO treasury portfolio is quite high, and maybe we should do something about that. Because this idea of sustainability, right, is not only about drinking out of a mug. It's also about making sure that you have some sort of longevity in your ecosystem. So it's an interesting topic, because I started looking at these different DAO treasury compositions on DeepDAO, and then I realized that some of them, they have 99.9% in their own token, right? I remember there's one point in time, it probably changed by now, but it's one point in time where I looked at Optimism. And Optimism's biggest position, of course, is OP tokens. And then its second largest position was either USDC or Ethereum. But it doesn't matter. Why? Because that second largest position was only $600 worth. And the biggest position was something like $6 billion, right? So basically, they don't have anything else. So sure enough, 6 days later, after I pondered on this, the market crashed. And I think they lost $1.2 billion, right, in their market cap, which teaches you a few things. And number one, whatever that market cap number is a nonsense, right? But number two, if you're worried about your longevity of your organization, decentralized organization in this case, you want to make sure that you can survive bad times, right? And that is quite important for those who are in charge of managing the finances of a DAO.
Today's episode is sponsored by the VeChain Foundation.
Now, we often talk about how emerging technologies like blockchain have the potential to revolutionize sustainability. And VeChain is at the forefront of this green movement with initiatives like VBetaDAO. Let's take a closer look.
Imagine tracking small actions, like recycling, at low cost, making them valuable assets. These verified records build a massive collective impact, benefiting people through their own actions. Sound a bit complex, but VeChain made it fun. Explore our apps at vbetter.com.
VeChain's goal is to power a new era of sustainable solutions. So if you've got an app idea or just want to earn rewards for small, sustainable actions every day, go check out vbetterdao.com to find out more. And now, back to the show. And this is, it's kind of brings us back to our earlier topic. Like, just because you're involved in a crypto token doesn't mean you necessarily know how to run a DeFi system or understand financial risk and whatnot. And the idea of specialization versus generalization. So is the kind of the take-home message that a lot of these DAOs, when they grow to a certain size, they really should start to have a diversified portfolio to not, you know, I don't want to sound too boring, but is that the point, that they should be interacting with specialists who can help them manage their portfolio to ensure they have this longevity and security?
It's a very tricky topic, right? Because sometimes if you speak to the hardcore degens, they will say, no, it should be like that. You should have 99% of your own token, because if you don't, then, and you know, if it all blows up, then we just go and do something else. But when I hear these comments, I really struggle, you know. And I think if you've accepted any sort of money from anyone, you have a bit of a fiduciary duty, whether you can be identified or not, right? It's just a moral thing that you try very hard to make sure that this thing can survive for a while. So I do think there is some valid reason for diversification. Now, it's difficult, right? Because imagine you're the treasurer of Uniswap, and then of course with platforms like Nansen and Into the Block and all these other database companies, right? The community will know. If you as a DAO treasurer start selling your own token, they will know. And then, you know, there's going to be a Twitter storm, right? Because everyone's like, okay, these guys lost confidence in their own project. And you can see it in Ethereum right now, right? If the Ethereum Foundation sells Ether, that's not very good for the Ethereum ecosystem. Whereas I always, as a bystander, I think they're damn smart. The price is not very, very low right now. Take some money off the table. You make this thing a lot more resilient in the long term, right? So that is something that perhaps everyone needs to think about a little bit. Very large companies just drawing to the world of traditional finance, right? Large companies sell their stock to raise capital to make sure that they can build their new projects, and that's perfectly fine. So I think I would see a parallel here to the world of DAOs and cryptocurrencies as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you're also kind of speaking to, I think, as the industry scales up and matures, the sheer amount of money involved in these DAOs and these projects overall will likely only increase, and you'll have kind of more professionalized ones as well. Maybe ones where people are quite willing to identify themselves with DAOs. You know, we've had those cases in the past, and not kind of operating on a fully anonymous or pseudonymous kind of version of these DAOs, but actually being quite public and open about who is involved in the future as well. I'm curious then, you mentioned this potential marriage between the world of traditional finance and DAOs, right? How they interact. What do you think that looks like in the future, ideally? So how do we get the big kind of financial players to interact with DAOs, or to use DAOs, maybe to create DAOs in the future? What does that look like in an ideal sense? Because I'm sure some people will be worried about, you know, what the implications are for the kind of crypto native community, right? Or for the blockchains and DAOs themselves. So yeah, how would you see that evolving?
Wow, there's a lot in your question. So let me try to go bit by bit. No. But I'm just saying there's a lot in there. So, right now, let's start with traditional finance, right? Traditional finance runs on a sort of basic assumption that you know who you're dealing with, right? So it's a very stark contrast to the world of blockchains, where, you know, you don't directly know who you're dealing with necessarily. Maybe you can infer and you can have all sorts of data science, but effectively there's no one-to-one match between my wallet and my name, right? So that presents a little bit of an issue. And this arguably is also the biggest legal issue for any traditional institution to do anything with a DAO, which is why one of the interviews that we have in the book with my lawyer friend Hagen Rook is also very interesting, because he talks a lot about how the structuring has been done in several cases to facilitate this collaboration. But I feel like at the moment we are perhaps more in a stage where these things are quick fixes. You know, they're not so clean. So I think for DAOs to succeed further, there also needs to be regulatory change. And this is something I'm particularly excited about, because you can strike a nice middle ground where on the one side, you don't have to send a copy of your passport to somebody. And on the other side, you also sort of protect the ecosystem from rogue actors and so on, right? So that is something that I believe that is required. And the good news is that many regulators, I mean, I think the Singapore regulator is probably leading the charge here, they are investigating, you know, how do zero knowledge proofs work? How can we make sure that these concepts can be used so that public blockchains can also be an option to conduct financial services activities, right? That would be a biggie for anything that is organized as a DAO today.
And that's really interesting, because you were talking about kind of, you know, when there's movements on chain, say a foundation starts to liquidate assets or move it to a different asset class, then there's a lot of panic and people are, okay, loss of confidence, and everything comes down to confidence. And that's one thing that I guess the blockchain provides, is a degree of transparency. So you have confidence in the activity that is on chain, whether that's good or bad. But the fact that you can see it is quite important. The more information, a lot of the times, the better. But there's a lot of things that are happening off chain as well, right? We're kind of talking about, say, different asset classes. Do you think that more and more we should try and put, so the thing you just said there was around account, the more information that is currently off chain that we put on chain is probably better for, say, anonymity, confidence in the system, confidence in the individuals that we're interacting with. Do you think more and more we'll start to see, say, traditional finance go more on chain, putting more of the information on chain, more of their activity on chain? And do you think the DAOs are doing that right now as well? Because I know that we're kind of talking earlier about a lot of the information that DAOs actually have and all their assets are off chain. So you need to kind of watch what they're saying and what to do and kind of think about everything that's hidden underneath as well.
Yeah. So I think it's already happening. You know, the adoption of blockchain in traditional finance is happening. But this transparency that you mentioned, in my mind, is a bug. It's not a feature. And I'm sometimes, you know, people look at me funny when I say that. But you think about it. If you can trace all transaction level data of a company, right? Basically, there's no room for anyone to interpret what that actually means. And there's always an immediate reaction. I don't know whether that level of transparency is so good. Equally, with all of the machine learning capabilities that we have, it's very easy to figure out who has really large Bitcoin wallets, right? And who controls them. And then it's only a matter of time before other people just break into somebody's house and abduct the kid and say, hey, we know that this wallet is yours and we want it, you know, we want all that money in there. So I think the privacy aspect of this will become more and more important, which is why I'm quite excited about those blockchains that also think about how to make transactions more private. And as a matter of fact, we have many laws around the world. In Europe, we have GDPR. In Singapore, we have PDPA that protect personal data. And so what we have to kind of marry is currently all of the requirements that financial services regulators have on the one side that are, of course, concerned with terrorist financing and money laundering and so on. But that's not all, right? And that's already a small amount of the overall transaction. So what's more important is how do we preserve the privacy? Because privacy, in my mind, is like a human right, is not necessarily something that you can use to auto-categorize somebody into the bad actor compartment, right? So that will be an interesting few years ahead, where some of this regulation will have to evolve as well.
Yeah, I think this is really important for highlighting something we said earlier, right? Is that now we're not just talking about voting, we're talking about voting and money, right? It's a kind of very it's kind of a very new way of combining those two things. And we know how important anonymity and privacy is when it comes to voting, especially kind of when we go to the ballot box ourselves, but in all other sorts of contexts as well. And there's all sorts of discussion around digital voting and the merits and demerits of that. But when you add in money to the mix, then the importance of that privacy is kind of tenfold, if not more, right? Or something like that. Because then, yeah, as you said, you can become a target with a measurable incentive to target you if you're involved in a DAO, potentially, that kind of thing. So yeah, I think that's definitely one of the kind of key risks I think people need to be aware of. What would you say are the other, if any, risks that people should know and how we can mitigate them for DAOs? Because we mentioned something like the DAO hack, right? That was probably if anyone knows of a vulnerability, then that's the one they'll have probably heard of, the Ethereum DAO hack. But yeah, what do you think people should be thinking of in general from a kind of risks perspective on DAOs?
I mean, if you're a financial institution and you deal with a DAO, there are a bunch of idiosyncratic risks that we also outline in the book, right? Apart from that accountability risk that we spoke about earlier, there's also what we call DAO community risk. You know, what happens if the community suddenly abandons the project, right? And then you build a product or a service that you're offering, or you want to participate in that ecosystem, and it basically is an empty shell, right? That is one risk. There is this what we call DAO financial risk, which we touched upon a little bit when we talked about treasury management and the longevity of these portfolios. So I think that is another very serious topic. You do have the governance risk as well, right? And basically governance risk is eventually the governance of the DAO becomes dysfunctional in some shape or form, whether it's through an external attack or whether internal players do some funny business. So that is also something to consider. There are some operational risks as well, right? So anything that has to do with people always bears the risk that somebody does something wrong. And I think what's very much underappreciated today is that you also have a technology risk associated to this. And if we can spend maybe 1 or 2 minutes on it, but in my mind, not all smart contract platforms are the same. They come with different characteristics. And if you choose as a DAO to build on a particular platform, you want to make sure that many characteristics are conducive to what you're trying to do with the DAO, right? So for example, if you build an automated market maker, you anticipate lots and lots of transactions for the people who use your platform. You cannot have a model where you can't predict the gas price, you know, because how are you going to build some sort of viable long-term model where you don't know what your operating cost is? That doesn't work. I mean, there's a whole chapter on this actually in the book, but I'll say two more examples, right? The first one that I wanted to bring up is stability. Some smart contract platforms on a regular basis stop working. So if you offer a critical service to your users and then suddenly your system stops working for 8 hours, I think that is probably not very conducive to what you're trying to do, right? I think there are some others, but one thing that we briefly spoke about is also privacy. So I do think that is a technological characteristic that will become more and more important. And often, as a DAO, you're dependent on what your smart contract platform has to offer on that side.
I guess on the risks involved, you mentioned like there's lots of operational risks, lots of people can make, you know, bad decisions and whatnot. But isn't that quite like a powerful kind of incentive to maybe be part of a DAO? Is because there's more people, there's more this data points, that there's more likelihood that there will be corrective measures to, say, address those, especially when there's competition. Whereas if we compare with, like, say, an individual that, you know, kind of does the whole thing themselves and they make all the decisions, if they go psychopath and just go down that one road and it seems like it's going crazy, but they have the entire power to say yes, no, and they keep going down that route, then is that like a potential kind of mitigating factor? DAOs, is there are a lot of people all kind of collectively making decisions, so it's more likely to correct that path if something goes wrong?
Yeah, it can be. And if you look into, again, I use Uniswap because I looked into it a little bit more. They have this time lock functionality, right? Where if a proposal is approved, I think there's a 24 or 48 hour period where the smart contract can be reviewed once more, just to make sure that there are no vulnerabilities, right? So people built into these guardrails to protect the ecosystem from these operational risks. And that is something that is very good, I think.
Yeah, I think that's quite fascinating. It's the same with like validators as well, right? You have to lock your stake in for 2-4 weeks. So if you do some kind of negative malicious behavior, there is an inbuilt kind of technology to ensure that, you know, you go down with the ship a little bit to disincentivize that. So like we've talked a little bit about how we think, you know, how you think DAOs are evolving. It seems like they're going to kind of align more with traditional finance in a way, you know, more risk management, kind of that kind of stuff. But also that traditional finance is going to align more with DAOs and maybe go more on-chain, be a bit more transparent. How do you see DAOs evolving like in the long term, say 10 years plus? Do you think they're going to be like part of our day-to-day? Do you think they're going to affect us like in the kind of the normal real-world sense as well?
It's interesting. So I don't think that, as we said in the beginning, that everything has to become a DAO. But I already do see some large corporations they're investigating how to restructure part of their organization as a DAO. So I do have one dear friend who is part of a very large insurance company, and they think about how to organize their sales agents, right? And then they said, oh, maybe we should organize them as a DAO. So these things are also happening inside of corporations, which I think is very exciting. So that is something that maybe we can see more of. I want to be a little bit careful because I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, if I think about what I thought is going to happen 10 years ago, you know, wow, that was very different from what eventually happened. And there's lots of things we couldn't predict. But I think for now, it's probably important to see the potential and also realize that there have been some successes where people have started whole ecosystems and they're run by a DAO and the decision-making sort of works. Of course, nothing is perfect. You could also argue, you know, there's all sorts of centralization tendencies and so on. But I also believe that you have to be fair to these DAO founders and that only over time they can reach their decentralization goal. It's not like you can have that from day one. Right? That is probably also not very realistic.
Yeah, I think that's it's good to highlight the need to be pragmatic when you're building these DAOs, right? And understanding things won't always be perfect. These are kind of ideals to strive for 100%. I think that's a good view of the future. I would be curious to know, is there one single kind of gets you out of bed use case project idea in the DAO space that, you know, you think, if I see this in the next 5 to 10 years, then I'll be really happy. I think we've achieved something. Is there one kind of that stands out to you in that regard?
So many things could be organized as a DAO. I mean, because I'm also a little bit in the education camp, right? I'm also thinking about, okay, how can we use these systems to incentivize people to learn about topics that are perhaps really important? So I give one example that I'm a little bit passionate about. I think there are many human beings on the planet that are not financially very literate. And because of that, they take decisions that become a bit of a problem for them further down the line. But then many people also are not interested in finance, right? It's not like, I mean, I wake up every morning and I think finance is great, but I know that many people find it boring and not interesting. But for them, it's also important to learn about finance. Otherwise, they make all these mistakes. So what if there was a DAO-based educational organization that could incentivize people to learn the basics of finance so that they can avoid these topics, right? That, I think, would be very, very exciting. And if that ever existed, I would be very excited about it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really lovely one. I think there's a kind of beautiful, almost irony in the aiming for a future where, you know, the crypto and Web3 space that is so derided for, you know, potentially being damaging financially to people, because of the lack of financial literacy, right? Because it's difficult to know, you know, how to use your money wisely and prepare for things like retirement. I think it would be great to see Web3 actually come up with a solution to incentivize how do we get that education? Because, you know, we're in the UK, it's not in a good state. I think financial literacy and financial education, it's not something you really, or when me and Alec were in school, it's not something that you really learn. And hence, you know, how we're two crypto degens now, but no, absolutely not. Thank you, Dan. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. Obviously, we'll link you out and make sure everyone can follow you and find you more. But I think LinkedIn's the best place to catch you, right?
Yeah, perfect. Thanks for having me. Awesome. It was a really interesting conversation. Thank you.
No, pleasure's all ours, Dan. Thank you very much. And thank you for listening. You can join us next week to untangle a little more Web3.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.